Welcome to Torah Imecha Nach Yomi with the OU Women's Initiative. My name is Lynn Kraft, and today we'll be learning Melachim Bet, Perek Yud Zayin, Chapter 17. In the last Perek, in Perek Tet Zayin, Chapter 16, we learned of the reign of Ahaz, an evil king in Malchut Yehuda who invited Ashur into the region in order to get help in ending the siege over Yerushalayim that had been led by Ritzin, the king of Aram, and Pekach ben Remaliahu, the king of Yisrael. But once Tiglath-Pileser, the king of Ashur, was already in the region, he proceeded to attack Damesek and kill its king, Ritzin. In today's parak, in Parak Yud Zayin, chapter 17, Tiglath-Pileser is now unfortunately going to set his sights upon the next country, immediately to the south of Aram, Malchut Yisrael. This is going to be the last parak in our sefer that discusses Malchut Yisrael, as it describes its downfall, its exile, and unfortunately its ultimate destruction. In Psukim Aleph through Bet, in verses 1 through 2, we are introduced to the last king of Malchut Yisrael, whose name was Hoshea ben Ela. He became the king in the 12th year of Ahaz's reign, and he ruled for 9 years. When describing his religious status, the pasuk actually starts out with its standard protocol in describing the kings of Malchut Yisrael, but then veers from it in a significant way. Ve'yas hara b'enei Hashem, he did evil in the eyes of Hashem, which is something familiar to us, unfortunately, when describing the kings of Malchut Yisrael. But then the pasuk continues, rak lo k'malchut Yisrael asher hayu lefanav, just not like the kings of Israel who were before him. And so it seems that while Hoshea ben Ela was not a great king, he was not as bad as his predecessors were. But what does that mean, right? In what specific way was Hoshea ben Ela not as bad as the kings who came before him? And so the Seder Olam Rabbah explains that during Hoshea ben Ela's reign, the king of Ashur came in and removed the Egli Zahav, the golden calves, from Beit El and Dan. These were the golden calves that Yeravam ben Nevat had placed there at the beginning of Malchut Yisrael that had been used to worship Hashem until now. But once he removed those golden calves, Bnei Yisrael had no way of worshiping Hashem anywhere within the borders of Malchut Yisrael anymore. And therefore, the Medrash explains, Ota sha'a kevan shara'a Hoshea ben Ela shegalu aglei hazahav. At that time, once Hoshea ben Ela saw that the golden calves were exiled, Amad ve'evir perdasa ocho shiv Yeravam ben Nevat al atzumin. He stood and removed the checkpoints that Yeravam ben Nevat had stationed along the borders, shelola alot liYerushalayim, that they shouldn't go up to Yerushalayim. And the proof the Medrash brings for this is actually from our pasuk, because instead of comparing Hoshea ben Ela to Yeravam ben Nevat in his causing Bnei Yisrael to sin by having them worship Hashem in Beit El and Dan, as the text does for almost every other king in Malchut Yisrael, he is instead described as not being as bad as his predecessors. So that must mean that he did not lead them to sin by worshiping Hashem in Beit El and Dan, as Yeravam ben Nevat and the rest of his predecessors did. Rather, Hoshea ben Ela must have removed the guards, who prevented the passage of Bnei Yisrael from Malchut Yisrael to Yerushalayim, enabling access to the Beit HaMikdash for the first time since Malchut Yisrael was created. And this understanding of Hoshea ben Ela is likely also based on the pasuk in Divrei HaYamim Bet, Perek Lamed, Pasuk Aleph, chapter 30, verse 1, in which we're told that Chizkiyahu, who was Ahaz's son, who reigns in Malchut Yehuda during the rest of Hoshea ben Ela's reign, invited the people of Malchut Yisrael to partake in the Karban Pesach, in the Paschal sacrifice, along with the people of Malchut Yehuda in the Beit HaMikdash. And that the few from Malchut Yisrael who responded to Chizkiyahu's invitation celebrated together with Malchut Yehuda in the Beit HaMikdash for the first time since the days of Shlomo. But this could have only happened with northern royal sanction. And so in this way, Hoshea ben Ela was not as bad as the kings who preceded him. But then we're left with another question, because if Hoshea ben Ela wasn't as bad as his predecessors were, why then did the gullet, did the exile, occur during his reign? And so the Al-Sheikh suggests that it's because until now, the sin of Bnei Yisrael's not going down to the Beit HaMikdash to worship Hashem fell squarely on the shoulders of the kings themselves, because they were the ones who had prevented Bnei Yisrael from going to the Beit HaMikdash for all of these years. But now that Hoshea ben Ela removed the obstacle to their going to the Beit HaMikdash and explicitly gave them permission to go, when most of them still chose themselves not to go, the sin transitioned from an avon yachid, a sin of an individual, to an avon rabim, a sin of the many, of the entire community. And that's why they were exiled and destroyed specifically during Hoshea ben Ela's reign, because almost the entire kingdom was now guilty of this sin, of worshiping Hashem outside the Beit HaMikdash, which is considered a form of avodah zarah, since it involves foreign worship of God, for which they deserve the ultimate punishment. Professor Gershon Galil, who's a professor of biblical studies and ancient history and former chair of the Department of Jewish History at the University of Haifa, and who wrote the chronology of the kings of Israel and Judah, proposes that Sefer Malachim emphasized that Hoshea ben Ela wasn't as bad as his predecessors in order to stress that the impending galut or exile of Malchut Yisrael could not then have been a punishment for the particular sins of Hoshea ben Ela or of his generation specifically, because he and they were actually less deserving of punishment than the previous kings and generations. Rather, this teaches us that the exile must have been a cumulative punishment for all the sins that the kings and the nation had perpetrated from the time of Yeravam ben Nevat until now. So let's reconstruct the events that led up to the conquest and exile of Malchut Yisrael by Ashur. According to Assyrian records, Hoshea ben Ela was originally appointed as king by Tiglath-Pileser, which meant that he was really a pro-Assyrian vassal king. And likely because of this, Bnei Yisrael did not initially suffer the same fate at the time as Aram did, whose king Ritzin was killed and whose capital city was invaded. Rather, Malchut Yisrael's king was allowed to rule the country as long as he paid a yearly tribute to Tiglath-Pileser in acknowledgement of Assyrian authority over his country. 4 years after Hoshea ben Ela's appointment as vassal, Tiglath-Pileser died and was succeeded by Shalmaneser, who did not have as cruel a reputation as Tiglath-Pileser did. And this fresh perception of Assyrian weakness motivated the countries in the region, including Malchut Yisrael and Mitzrayim, to form a coalition in order to overthrow Assyrian control. We're told in Pasuk Gimel in verse 3 that Shalmaneser came to the region to consolidate his power. Hoshea ben Ela, we're told, became his servant and paid him tribute. However, in the next Pasuk, in Pasuk Dalet verse 4, we're told that after some time, Shalmaneser found out that Hoshea ben Ela had sent messengers to So, Melech Mitzrayim, the king of Egypt, and he likely assumed that Hoshea ben Ela was attempting to create a rebellious alliance with So, the king of Mitzrayim. Shalmaneser also noticed that Hoshea ben Ela hadn't paid tribute to him that year as he had done in previous years. And so in response, he put Hoshea ben Ela in jail. And in Pasuk Hey, in verse 5, he attacked Malchut Yisrael and besieged its capital city of Shomron. 3 years later, after Sargon had succeeded Shalmaneser as king of Ashur, we're told in Pasuk Vav, verse 6, Bishnat hachi'it lehoshea, in the ninth year of Hoshea, lachad melech Ashur et Shomron. The king of Ashur conquered Shomron, vayagel et Yisrael Ashura, and he exiled Israel to Ashur. Vayoshev otam bachlach uvechavor nahar gozen ve'aremadai. And he settled them in Chlach Chavor on the river Gozen in the cities of the Medes.
Hi, it's Adina Shminman. Behind every thriving Jewish community are remarkable women. This Shavasar B'Tammuz, meet three of them. Meet a student of Rebbetzin Vichna Kaplan, the founder of Beis Yaakov in the United States. Hear from a woman whose family has been proudly from in America since 1840, and learn from the daughter of one of the pioneers of OU Kashrus. This Shavasar B'Tammuz, discover how these remarkable women and their families helped build the Jewish communities we know today. Find out more and sign your community up at ouwomen.org/gathering26. That's ouwomen.org/gathering26. And now back to today's Perek.
After the Perek explains that the Assyrian conquest of Malchut Yisrael happened in political terms, that it was in response to Hoshea's rebellion against Ashur, etc., the Perek then goes on in Pasuk Zayin in verse 7 to explain it in religious terms. Vayihi ki chatzu b'nei Yisrael l'Hashem Elokeihen, and it was because b'nei Yisrael sinned to Hashem their God. Hamaleh otam me'eretz Mitzrayim, who took them up from the land of Egypt, mitachat yad Paro melech Mitzrayim, from under the hand of Paro, the king of Egypt. Vayiru Elohim achirim, and they feared foreign gods. The parak then continues in Psukim Chet through Chaf Gimel in verses 8 through 23 to explain in a lot more detail all the sins that led to the exile. We're told that B'nai Yisrael worshipped Avodah Zarah and also generally did not follow the Torah, instead following in the ways of the surrounding nations whom they had driven out when they conquered the land and in whose ways they were specifically told not to follow. They also did not listen to the Nevi'im, the prophets whom Hashem sent to rebuke them and encourage them to do tshuva, for they were stubborn like their ancestors who did not believe in God. So for the first time in Sefer Malachim, the focus has shifted away from royal sins and responsibility to the sins and guilt of the people as a whole. Interestingly, in describing these sins, Yirmiyahu uses similar wording to the Torah passages, especially in the Tochacha, the portion of rebuke in Vayikra, Perek Chavav, chapter 26, in which Hashem warned Bnei Yisrael that if they committed these sins, they would be exiled. And unfortunately, we see this happening here. The question we can ask is, why did Hashem specifically decide to punish Bnei Yisrael with galut or exile? Why was that considered an appropriate punishment for their sins? And It really is, because Gullet is not merely a physical displacement, right, in which the people are sent away from their homeland and forced to give up their sovereignty. It's really also a spiritual displacement in which the people were sent away from Hashem himself. And so because B'nai Yisrael rejected Hashem when they abandoned his Torah and worshipped other gods, Hashem is now rejecting them by sending them away from his presence, which is most directly felt in Eretz Yisrael. That being said, it's still important to note that B'nai Yisrael was not the only nation that was exiled by the Assyrians and whose religious shrines they destroyed. Ashur's foreign policy was actually to exile all the nations they conquered from their native lands and to destroy their temples at that time. And there was a reason that they developed this policy, because the Assyrians understood that if they left the conquered nations, the conquered peoples in their own lands, they would actually be much more likely to rebel against their foreign Assyrian occupiers, using their more intimate knowledge of their own land to launch attacks on the conquering forces, kind of like the Polish partisans were able to take advantage of their intimate knowledge of the local terrain and their consequent ability to navigate the dense local forests, right, in order to sabotage the Nazis who occupied Poland in countless ways during World War II. And so to prevent that kind of thing from happening, the Assyrians exiled their conquered peoples to new, unfamiliar territory in order to keep them subjugated and unable to rebel. Furthermore, they destroyed the temples of the conquered peoples because as pagans, they believed that the destruction of a god's temple here on earth by a conquering country represented that god's weakness and defeat in the face of the more powerful god of the dominant country. And so both of these aspects of foreign policy were really intended to demoralize the conquered peoples, as well as to facilitate the eventual loss of their original identity. Now, interestingly, archaeology actually shows that there was a huge influx of people into Malchut Yehuda at this time, presumably by members of the Ten Shvatim, of the Ten Tribes of Malchut Yisrael, who did not want to go into Gullah, into exile, but preferred to remain with their brethren in the south of Eretz Yisrael. Over time, it seems that they lost their distinct tribal identities and became absorbed in the general society of Malchut Yehuda. Unfortunately, those members of the Ten Shvatim who did go into exile essentially disappeared. They were removed from their land, and they were scattered throughout the Assyrian Empire without a leader to unify them, and so eventually, through assimilation and intermarriage, they ceased to exist as an identifiable nation. In fact, the chaos and confusion wrought by Ashur in the ancient Near East overall, not just to our nation, but to all nations, it's actually reflected in Chazal's application of a halacha that appears in Devarim Perachav Gimel Psukim Dal through Tet, chapter 23, verses 4 through 9, which tells us that B'nai Yisrael are actually not allowed to accept converts from the nations of Ammon, Moab, Mitzrayim, and Edom. And Chazal explain in the Mishnah Yadayim, in Perak Dalid, Mishnah Dalid, that Amar lo Rabbi Yoshua. Rabbi Yoshua said to, we know from context, it was Rabban Gamliel, V'chi Amonim Moavim v'mekomanhim, and our Amonim and Moavim in their countries, Kfar Allah Sancheirev Melech Ashur uvilbel et kol ha'umot. Sancheirev, the king of Ashur, already got up and mixed up all the nations. And so the Mishnah actually teaches us that since the Assyrians mixed up all the nations throughout their empire, we can no longer identify who belongs to which nation. And therefore, we are now allowed to accept converts from any nation, because we can assume, based on the concept of rov, which is majority, that a potential convert did not come from any of the other of these four nations, because the rov of them, the majority of them, will have come from the other nations who are allowed to convert. As a case in point, how actually, we're told in Pasuk Chav Dalet in verse 24 of our Perek, that when Malchut Yisrael was exiled from Shomron, other nations from other countries, Mi Bavel, Umi Kuta, Umi Ava, Umi Chamat, Usfarvayim, were actually placed in Shomron as a substitute for B'nai Yisrael, eventually becoming known as the Shomronim because they settled there. It seems that Ashur was aware that if they left any particular land that they conquered completely empty, especially what we know ultimately happened in Eretz Yisrael in like the, you know, the 19th centuries, when it was completely abandoned, it became swampland, right? All the fertile farmland, etc., that was able to produce so much food just basically fell into nothingness. And so the Assyrians assumedly knew that, and they didn't want to leave any place empty. So instead of just moving people to one place, they basically played chess with the ancient Near East, and they moved people around. And, you know, because they moved B'nai Yisrael out of Shomron, they now replaced them with other people from other places in the empire into Shomron. In Pasuk Chaf Hei, verse 25, we're told that when these foreign pagans first moved to Shomron, Vayihi b'tzchilat shevtam sham, and it was in the beginning of their dwelling there, lo yaru et Hashem, they did not fear God, obviously, they were pagans from other lands, Vayishalach Hashem bahem et ha'arayot, and Hashem sent among them the lions, Vayihuyu horgim bahem, and they were killing some of them. It seems that since these new immigrants did not fear God, Hashem sent lions to attack them, and they even succeeded in killing some of them. Now, why would this be? The pagans weren't told to worship God. They didn't know about God. Why would they be punished? It seems that this wasn't necessarily a punishment for the people themselves, who were really just ignorant of Hashem's existence, but rather demonstrates the land's inability to handle Avodah Zarah, right? Eretz Yisrael, after having been lived in by worshippers of God for so long, literally, just like we're told with the Arei Miklat, right? It can't handle spilled blood of murder. And that's why, you know, someone who kills by accident must leave and go into exile. So too, the land of Eretz Yisrael couldn't handle the worship of Avodah Zarah within its boundaries. And so Hashem sent a punishment to those who were doing it because the land couldn't handle it. In response, in Psukim Chav Vav through Mem Aleph, in verses 26 through 41, we're told that the Shomronim complained to the king of Ashur because they couldn't live in a country where this was happening to them. And the king of Ashur responded by commanding a Kohen who had originally been exiled from Achol Yisrael to now return there in order to teach these Shomronim how to worship Hashem, in the hopes that that would end the lion attacks. And now recall that this man who's called a Kohen must not have actually been a real Kohen who descended from Aharon HaKohen, since one of Yerovam ben Nevat's reforms in the newly formed Machal Yisrael back in Malachim Aleph Perek Yud Bet, chapter 12, allowed anyone who wanted outside of Shevet Levi to become a Kohen. So this pseudo-Kohen, we're told, moved back to Beit El in order to teach the Shomronim there, and in Shomron in general, how to serve Hashem. And even after learning how to worship Hashem, we're told the Shomronim continued to worship their own gods, but it seems that they added Hashem to their already existing pantheon. And because of this, the lion attacks ceased, and they continued to live in Malchut Yisrael pretty peacefully. Now, this is actually an important piece of history to remember because it will ultimately have a huge impact on the generation of Shivat Zion, those who returned to Eretz Yisrael about 200 years later. When some of the exiles of Malchut Yehuda returned from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael 70 years after the Chorban, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, in order to rebuild that Beit HaMikdash, we're told in Ezra Perek Daleth, chapter 4, that these same Shomronim wanted to participate in the building of the Beit HaMikdash since they claimed to worship Hashem as well. In fact, they were likely afraid that if they did not participate, Hashem would favor the Jews over them and they would be punished, perhaps by being attacked by lions yet again. But the leaders of Bnei Yisrael at that time, Zerubbabel ben Shealtiel and Yeshua ben Yehotzadak, actually refused to allow the Shomronim to participate in the building of Beit Sheni of the Second Temple, since by definition they didn't worship Hashem correctly, as they also worshiped their own gods in addition to worshiping Hashem, which is outright Avodah Zarah. And in addition to not wanting Ovdei Avodah Zarah, worshippers of foreign gods, to take part of the actual building of the Beit HaMikdash itself, the leaders of the time were also extremely nervous about assimilation and intermarriage, and they were afraid that the Shomronim would be bad influences on the fledgling new community that they had just begun to reestablish in Eretz Yisrael. We're told the Shomronim became so upset in response to this rejection that they convinced Koresh, the king of Paras of Persia at the time, to halt the building of the Beit HaMikdash. And they actually succeeded in delaying its construction for several years afterwards, until the reign of Daryavesh, when the returnees were finally able to convince the new king to allow them to complete the construction of Beit Sheni, of the Second Temple, on their own. Our perek ends with a summative description of these Shomronim in the last pasuk, in pasuk Mem Aleph, verse 41. Vayihiyu hagoyim ha'ela yirei imet Hashem, and these nations were God-fearing. Ve'et psilehem hayu ovdim, and their idols they would serve. Gam b'nehem uv'nei v'nehem, also their children and their children's children, kasher asu avotam, him osim arei yom hazeh. Like their fathers did, so do they to this day, meaning until the day of Yirmiyahu, which was the time of the Chorban of Bayit Rishon of the first Beit HaMikdash. And in this final description of the Shomronim's newly learned fear of Hashem while they were still worshiping their foreign gods, I think we can't help but hear a very loud echo of the way the people of Machal Yisrael themselves behaved, since they also worshipped both Hashem and foreign gods at the same time. As we learned earlier in this parak, this was one of the main reasons why the kingdom of Machal Yisrael was destroyed and its people were punished with exile. By worshipping foreign gods in addition to Hashem, the people of Machal Yisrael essentially rejected Hashem. And so Hashem rejected them by sending them away from his presence in Eretz Yisrael. Unfortunately, this is the last we will hear of Malchut Yisrael and Sefer Melachim. Starting in the next parak, in Parak Yudchet, chapter 18, we will begin to focus solely on the fate of Malchut Yehuda, following its trajectory until its own unfortunate and ultimate destruction and exile, about 150 years down the line. This year is dedicated by Michelle Levine and Susan Schuster and their families in memory of their beloved mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother, Rebbetzin Gloria Leff, Golda Tzivia Bat Baruch. Rebbetzin Leff was a highly regarded principal and Torah teacher, a master educator, whose deep love for teaching Tanakh inspired hundreds of students throughout her lifetime.